president of the United States or member of Congress when you can't even demand that Netanyahu let foreign and Israeli journalists, including U.S. journalists, into Gaza to freely report? He's been blocking this for years, and Israeli military is targeted, as you indicated. Palestinian journalists, they've killed over 165 of them, including, in addition to members of their own family, targeting apartments, for example. They've killed over 200 members of UNRWA, the UN Relief. They're out to destroy every relief center, every food feeding center of UNRWA, education center. Right now, let's put it in comparative terms here. More Palestinians have been killed since October 8th than have been killed by the U.S. in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden. Now, that total death toll was about 240,000 people. And those deaths were in countries, Germany and Japan, with 160 million population. Here we only have 2.3 million population. And all you got to do is read the Israeli press, read Haaretz, read the statements by 17 Israeli human rights groups.
Ralph Nader, we want to thank you for being with us. Longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time former presidential candidate. We'll link to your article in the Capitol Hill Citizen, Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. That does it for our show.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, three Portland mayoral candidates have a record of parking and traffic tickets. Federal regulators consider new rules to protect pedestrians from ever-growing SUVs and trucks. And in national news, presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump will debate for the first time tonight. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 10th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Three candidates in the race to become Portland's next mayor have poor driving and parking records. Commissioner Rene Gonzalez's driver's license has been suspended twice since the late 90s, and he's gotten seven speeding tickets. One of those was dismissed. Commissioner Carmen Rubio was issued more than 150 parking and traffic violations over the past 20 years. Records obtained by the Oregonian indicate she failed to pay these tickets on time, and her car was impounded twice. At least three of those tickets were given since she took office as commissioner in Portland in 2021. Mayoral candidate Keith Wilson racked up 13 tickets since 1992. One of those was dismissed, and eight of them were parking tickets. His most recent ticket was in April, when he apparently didn't pay the parking meter downtown. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is proposing new safety measures that would save almost 70 lives a year. As of Monday, the Road Safety Agency has urged the auto industry to change the design of new SUVs and pickup trucks in efforts to reduce pedestrian deaths and injuries. Pedestrian deaths rose a staggering 57% over the past decade. The agency believes that redesigning the hoods and fronts of passenger vehicles 10,000 pounds or less, SUVs, and trucks could be the solution. The rule is aimed largely at trucks and SUVs, which have grown in size and height over the years, and with that, so have the blind spots for their drivers. The ruling would set test procedures to simulate head-to-hood collisions with human head-like crash dummies, new safety requirements, and match global standards for pedestrian safety measures. If this does get adopted, the U.S. would be joining the global community on consensus on what needs to be done to protect pedestrians. But Americans prefer large trucks and SUVs more than the rest of the world. They accounted for almost 80% of new vehicle purchases since August. The public and automakers will have 60 days to comment on the proposal until the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration will draw up their final regulation. Oregon voters will decide on a potential change to the state's electoral system in November. If passed, Measure 117 would create a ranked choice voting system in federal and statewide elections and give cities and counties the ability to adopt this type of voting system as well. Melanie Billings-Yoon with the League of Women Voters of Portland says the system would replace primaries with a single ballot where voters could rank several candidates based on their preference. She says some candidates initially deemed unelectable could benefit.
I certainly have felt that way back in previous elections. Is it safe for me to vote for this candidate? Would she be unelectable? What we found is that ranked choice voting opens the door to many more women and people of color to be elected.
Ranked choice voting has already been adopted in some localities in Oregon, including Benton County, which adopted it in 2020, and Portland, which will have its first ranked choice election this year. Opponents say the system would be too confusing or complicated for voters. A report from 2020 found nearly half of the winners nationally in local races under ranked choice voting systems were women, compared to less than a quarter in jurisdictions without ranked choice voting. Billings-Yoon says other advantages to the system could include changing the tenor of politics in the state.
It discourages negative campaigning and favors candidates who find common ground. This has become such a problem across our nation, but really also in our state, where we're seeing sometimes that the whole government grinds to a stop because the sides are in such high opposition.
In the 2023 session, lawmakers approved the vote on the ballot change this November. Billings-Yoon says there's another way to describe ranked choice.
In some cases, it's called instant transfer, so that if their candidate is eliminated, their next choice would be considered to be their vote.
Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will be speaking to voters across the country tonight in their debate. One of the differences that'll likely be highlighted are policy proposals, including the right-wing playbook called Project 2025. Alex Gonzalez reports from Nevada.
The highly anticipated debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris is tonight. And as Election Day inches closer, more attention is being placed on the role toss-up states such as Nevada will play. Harris has launched an issues page on her campaign website outlining a number of her policy decisions and how they differ from Project 2025, a controversial policy playbook issued by a right-wing think tank called the Heritage Foundation. While Trump has tried to distance himself from Project 2025, it's proved to be quite a challenge since many influential Trump loyalists and allies are behind it. Julie Milliken with the nonprofit Media Matters for America says the Heritage Foundation has a proven track record of success.
They have consistently gotten the majority of their mandate for leadership proposals implemented by incoming Republican administrations, again, going back to Reagan.
Milliken says that in the first year of the Trump administration, the Heritage Foundation touted that more than two-thirds of their mandates were enacted under Trump. She says that speaks to why Project 2025 has to be taken seriously, which would revamp or completely eliminate certain federal agencies, such as the Department of Education and the National Weather Service. The debate will be hosted by ABC and will start at 6 p.m. Pacific time. Milliken considers Project 2025 to be what she calls expansive and extreme, which she says can lead voters to feel overwhelmed. In her perspective, Project 2025 boils down to an agenda of wanting control over many aspects of everyday life.
There are strict definitions of who it is that can be married. There are strict definitions about what women's role is, which is primarily just to have children and raise children. And outside of that, they don't have a lot of other worth.
Milliken encourages voters to contrast Project 2025's proposals with their own personal values, as it can be an easier and more effective way to determine the impact the playbook could have on the things that matter most to them. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
A U.S. district court is considering a lawsuit filed by Oregon, seven other states, and the Federal Trade Commission to block a proposed merger between Kroger and Albertsons. The CEOs of these grocery companies say the merger will allow them to cut prices to consumers, but many people, and certainly the states in the lawsuit, have their doubts. A new report details how the lack of competition due to corporate consolidation in the nation's food system contributed to rising grocery prices. Eric Galatis has more.
As a federal judge considers a lawsuit aiming to block a proposed $25 billion merger between Kroger and Albertsons, a new report details how skyrocketing grocery store prices are linked to record profits and a lack of competition between a shrinking number of corporations that dominate the nation's food system. Rakeen Mahboud is an economist with Groundwork Collaborative, the D.C.-based think tank behind the report.
There are only a few companies that control big chunks of entire supply chain that gets food to grocery stores. And that consolidation, the fact that there are only a few companies that really control the supply chain, facilitates price gouging and profiteering.
The report recommends expanding laws banning price gouging, already at work in some 40 states, including Louisiana, Tennessee, and Texas, nationwide. It also calls for limiting mergers that reduce competition. Grocers have blamed rising prices on the pandemic and other supply chain disruptions. Kroger has also argued that the proposed merger would help bring down prices, benefit workers, and allow them to compete with companies such as Amazon and Walmart. Mahboud points to comments made by Kroger and other supermarket executives to shareholders, admitting that inflation was good for boosting profits. She adds that cargo ships, railroads, and trucks are all owned by just a handful of firms.
Our supply chain was built to maximize profits for giant corporations that control it. It was not built to maximize efficient delivery of goods.
Mahboud notes healthcare, housing, and education costs have also been on the rise for decades.
The conversation around grocery prices is really part and parcel of a broader set of power dynamics that we need to disrupt. And that problem is that big corporations have way too much power and everyday people have too little.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Trump threatens to jail election officials if he wins. President Biden vows to veto any short-term spending that includes proof of citizenship to vote, and Senate Democrats highlight impacts from the Supreme Court's presidential immunity ruling. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
These comments are not political. They are tyrannical. They don't speak to the rule of law. What they speak to is one person's grievance.
Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says former President Donald Trump's threat to jail election officials harms the nation's bipartisan poll workers and volunteers. In an online post, Trump said election officials, lawyers, political operatives, and donors, who he says will try to cheat him out of his inevitable victory, would face long-term prison sentences. Threats against election workers have skyrocketed since 2020, but Trump surrogate North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum says he's just putting people on notice.
And I think this could have been a statement that could have come from the Harris campaign as well, because everybody's concerned in this country about making sure that our elections are free and fair.
The former president recently told a podcast that he lost in 2020, something he's never publicly admitted before. Meanwhile, Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris will meet tonight in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate. It starts at 9 p.m. Eastern. Trump is preemptively criticizing the ABC News moderators as unfair. Harris has said she's prepared for Trump to misrepresent facts. Congress is back in session and members have just weeks to pass a short-term budget or risk a government shutdown. House Republicans say they'll attach a requirement for voters to prove their citizenship to any funding that won't pass the Senate, and President Joe Biden says he'd veto it. Karine Jean-Pierre is White House press secretary.
It is a simple job. It's their number one job as Congress is to keep the government open, and we believe it should be with a short-term CR.
Senate Democrats say they'll hold a hearing on the far-reaching consequences of the Supreme Court's presidential immunity ruling. The 6-3 decision dealt a major setback to a federal case against Trump for trying to overturn the 2020 election. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson says she's concerned the ruling has created a two-tier justice system.
I was concerned about a system that appeared to provide immunity for one individual under one set of circumstances.
An Idaho judge has ruled a proposal to end closed party primaries and instead use ranked choice voting can appear on the November ballot there. Opponents have claimed it would be too expensive and confusing for voters, but Margaret Kinzel with Idahoans for Open Primaries says people use it all the time.
We send somebody to the grocery store and say, buy the apple pie. If they don't have apple, get blueberry. And so it really is this idea of we express our preference. If that preference is not available, we move on to our second preference.
And the Michigan Supreme Court has ruled Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s name will appear on that battleground state's ballot, despite Kennedy ending his campaign to support Trump. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our interview with Jamie Dunphy from Music Portland about the organization's fight against a potential Live Nation venue in the city. At 6, it's This Way Out, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 68. Today in history, in 2022, King Charles III was formally proclaimed the monarch of the United Kingdom after the death of Queen Elizabeth. The quote of the day is from American actor James Earl Jones, who passed away yesterday. He said, quote, "When I read great literature, great drama, speeches, or sermons, I feel that the human mind has not achieved anything greater than the ability to share feelings and thoughts through language." A hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, illegally discriminated against indigenous customers. Now they're filing for bankruptcy after a boycott from the community. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The parent company of the Grand Gateway Hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, has filed for bankruptcy. This comes amid a lawsuit from a Native advocacy group accusing the hotel of restricting the access of Indigenous peoples to the property. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
In 2022, Connie Urey, the owner of the Rapid City Hotel, aimed to, quote, "no longer allow any Native on property following an act of violence." That sparked deep controversy, a social media firestorm, and multiple lawsuits levied at the hotel, both federal and civil. The civil suit filed by Rapid City-based Indigenous Advocacy Network Indian Collective was due to begin Monday, September 9th. However, the announcement of bankruptcy protection has effectively halted the proceedings. Nick Tilson is CEO of the group. He describes mixed feelings as the announcement delays what he sees as a strong case against Retzel Corporation.
The Retzel Corporation basically had no out at this point. And there's a cost for racism. When you become both morally bankrupt as a result of racism, it could lead to you becoming financially bankrupt. It's not a small thing to go through bankruptcy. It does absolutely feel like that justice is delayed at the moment, and it doesn't feel good. You know, it doesn't feel good because we wanted to see racism on trial.
Sonny Redbear is associate director of organizing with the group. She says the situation and legal battle represent a culture of institutionalized discrimination in the Rapid City area.
We're seeing this in our community, and they need to face their roles in maintaining that inequality. The fight for justice in Rapid City won't stop until every system is held accountable for the harm that it has caused Native people. So we're challenging Rapid City to make a choice, continuing allowing racism to fester or stand up and reject it once and for all.
The trial is now on hold until bankruptcy proceedings are completed. I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
A bill adding Indigenous languages to Alaska's official list recently became law without the governor's signature. Its passage means Alaska now officially recognizes 23 Alaska Native languages. KTOO's Clarice Larson reports.
The new additions to the list are Chupig, Middle Tanana, Lower Tanana, and Wetal. Middle and Lower Tanana were previously classified as just one language. Juneau Representative Andy Story sponsored the bill. She's a Democrat and is running uncontested for re-election this year. She says it's a significant win for all residents in the state.
I just think it enriches all of us, Native and non-Native, to know about our language and the culture and embrace it.
The law expands and renames a council that advocates for the survival and revitalization of Indigenous languages in the state. Previously called the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council, it's now called the Council for Alaska Native Language. The majority of the state's Indigenous languages are critically endangered. And in a report released this spring, the council stated that Alaska Native languages are at a crucial juncture. The chairman of the council, Hune Lance Twitchell, strongly advocated in favor of the bill in testimony earlier this year. Twitchell teaches Alaska Native languages at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau.
Every single Alaska Native language is sacred and irreplaceable. It contains concepts that cannot be translated. It contains things that cannot be replaced and that give a sense of fulfillment and wholeness and health to Alaska Natives and to non-Natives in Alaska.
Two seats will be added to the council, and it will be moved from the Department of Commerce to the Department of Education and Early Development to better reflect the council's focus on education. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It's been about 8 years since e-scooters became popular in American cities. E-scooter rentals are helping clean the air, but a lot depends on the way that scooter companies manage their fleets. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
E-scooters that people can rent via an app on their phone are now available in hundreds of American cities, helping to clear the air by cutting down on car trips. E-scooter companies are now working to reduce their own carbon footprint. Andrew Savage is head of sustainability for the country's biggest e-scooter company called Lime.
As we provide emissions-free transportation to our customers, it's really important that we walk the walk. So we're trying to send a signal to the market that there's a demand among freight owners to decarbonize.
Lime says they are using more electric vans to collect and reposition the scooters, and they hire zero-emissions trucks to pick up their product at the ports. They're also using batteries that can be switched out in the field rather than bringing the scooter back for maintenance. Colin Murphy with the nonprofit Shared Use Mobility Center says e-scooters mark one step toward making modern transportation more sustainable.
These small, little efficient vehicles aren't going to solve 80 years of car-centric city planning by themselves. You know, they've got to be part of a robust set of investments by cities into other ways of getting around that people will feel safe using.
Studies show that between a third and a half of all people would have walked if they didn't rent an e-scooter, but the rest still avoid enough emissions to cover the scooter's carbon footprint. Estimates of savings can vary, but some studies have found that over their lifetimes, shared scooters can use as little as one-third the carbon dioxide of a gas car for every mile traveled. This story was produced using original reporting from Cyrus Valentine from grist.org. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and release of hostages remains remote, due largely to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on total victory in Gaza and escalation of the war in the West Bank. One Israeli official says, quote, he has blood on his hands, end quote. But no one seems to be able to make him change course. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. U.S. officials are saying that Hamas and Israel have agreed to 14 of 18 paragraphs in a ceasefire and hostage prisoner exchange deal, making it seem that an agreement is within reach. But two developments in the Israel-Hamas war undermine that hope. The refusal of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to put any such agreement ahead of Israel's military objectives, and, relatedly, expansion of Israel's assault on the West Bank along the same lines it pursued in Gaza. Here's a telling quote from families of the hostages. After close to a year of neglect, Netanyahu doesn't miss a single opportunity to ensure that there won't be a deal. Not a day goes by in which Netanyahu doesn't take concrete action to jeopardize the return home of all the hostages, unquote. Those are the outraged words of the Hostages and Missing Families Forum in protest of a cabinet decision to maintain an Israeli Defense Forces presence, that's the IDF, along the Philadelphia Corridor. The corridor is the 9-mile strip that separates southern Gaza from Egypt. This latest Israeli decision undermines any notion that Netanyahu is serious about agreeing to even a temporary ceasefire and exchange of prisoners for hostages. To the contrary, as the liberal newspaper Haaretz charges, quote, Israel prefers retrieving dead hostages to making concessions to rescue the living. Protests across Israel are intensifying as more dead hostages are recovered. An unidentified senior official in Netanyahu's administration said there's blood on the prime minister's hands. He knew there were orders to kill the hostages if there would be rescue attempts. The one vote against the corridor presence was by Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Reflecting the views of the military, Gallant said the decision would condemn the hostages to death. In response to Netanyahu's insistence that control of the Philadelphia corridor is cardinal, Benny Gantz, leader of the National Unity Party, said, quote, the hostages must be returned, even at a very heavy price. But Netanyahu is unmoved. Asked the other day if he thought Netanyahu was doing enough on the hostage issue, President Biden said simply, no. That's surely the understatement of the year. In fact, Netanyahu was just then on Israeli TV reciting why the IDF would have to remain in control of the Philadelphia corridor. He followed up with a press conference in which he insisted, as he always has, that only military pressure on Hamas can lead to the release of the hostages. That's demonstrably untrue. Only 8 hostages have been rescued in Israeli military operations. We therefore have to conclude that Netanyahu's real reason for keeping the IDF in Gaza is to occupy it permanently. And not only Gaza. Israel's military operations in the West Bank have come to resemble its attacks in Gaza. Here's an eyewitness report by a Palestinian journalist. Quote, for nearly a week, the Israeli military has been laying siege to hospitals in Jenin and other cities in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, severely restricting access to medical care, targeting medical workers and ambulances, and cutting off water and electricity as part of a massive military offensive, the largest operation in the Palestinian territory in over 2 decades. He adds, quote, Jenin's streets are now empty, with residents staying indoors for safety. The sounds of explosions and gunfire fill the streets amid the steady rumble of the bulldozers. Dozens of residents have been arrested from the street or in house raids. The United Nations Secretary General called for the offensive to stop, and after a week it did. But clearly it is just the beginning of another major military campaign, the real purpose of which is to extend Israel's occupation at the behest of the settler population. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz wrote on X, quote, "We must deal with the threat just as we deal with the terrorist infrastructure in Gaza, including the temporary evacuation of Palestinian residents and whatever steps might be required. This is a war in every respect, and we must win it." On the other hand, Ronan Bar, the head of Shin Bet, Israel's security agency, warned Netanyahu in a letter that settlers' violence amounted to terror, that's a quote, "and a large stain on Judaism and on all of us." To the far right, there is no such stain, but rather an opportunity to remove the Palestinian population altogether. So is a deal really within sight? Consider that the Philadelphia corridor is not part of the deal and could well be a deal breaker, since it involves the crucial issue of a continued Israeli military presence in a densely populated area of Gaza. Will Hamas yield on the issue? Unlikely. Will Netanyahu? Don't bet on it. As a commentator for Haaretz put it, Netanyahu's long-standing aims are a holy trinity: maintain the occupation, stay in power, and undermine the Israeli left. So far, in spite of enormous public outcries for him to resign, he's on course. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 10th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Zachary Jones-Naray and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, Eric Galatis, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, wonderful folks like you. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.